Our second case this morning is United States against Bush. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Lieutenant Commander Tom Belsky on behalf of the appellant in this case, Marco Bush. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Court of Criminal Appeals interpretation and misapplication of this court's decision in Allende, in this case, it misapplied it in three ways: to improperly deny the appellant relief and prejudicial post-trial delay. First, it improperly applied the Allende decision to its analysis of prejudice under the so-called Barker factors, an issue that the Allende court did not even address or discuss. Second, it improperly applied the Allende decision in such a way so as to create the effective result of shifting to the appellant the burden of proving that a constitutional error was harmful. And finally, the lower court interpreted Allende in such a way to place it in conflict with this court's seminal decision, United States versus Ginn. For all these reasons, it is appropriate to vacate the lower court's decision, find that there was a constitutional violation in this case that was not harmless, and remand for determination of appropriate.
Do we know from the record why the appellant did not submit any pay stubs?
No, we don't, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record to indicate one way or the other.
So he says he was employed by Costco in California. And what evidence in the record is there that he was employed by Costco in California?
You do have the appellant's unrebutted, uncontested affidavit that the lower court, under its powers under Article 66, did find, especially in light of Ginn, was an appropriate factual basis for making his determination.
So Costco has checks the 214s in Alabama but not in California? Is that what we're to assume?
There's no indication that either way. It could have been, it would be speculation as to maybe it slipped through on the California side and not the Alabama side.
Or they don't care in California and they care in Alabama?
We don't know, Your Honor. It's something the government, because it did have a specific store in Alabama, the government very easily could have tried to determine and present an affidavit on that matter.
But isn't it fair, at least before shifting burden, for the appellant to do all that was in his reasonable ability to do before you shift the burden? There's a difference between, say, running around getting 43 affidavits, but a pay stub is clearly within the appellant's own power. I mean, presumably he was paid. That's the whole issue, right? He wasn't working there for free.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why shouldn't we require of something of the appellant before shifting the burden?
And that's exactly what was happening in this case. He did have a specific assertion from the appellant.
But all we had was the assertion of the appellant. We had the bald assertion that of this Costco situation, and that he wasn't hired at the second Costco because he didn't have a DD-214. But that type of evidence, while it's certainly a statement, that would not be admissible at a Dubay. That's hearsay. And so why can't we say to the appellant here, you're making this claim, bring us something from that employer that will support that claim, some direct evidence. And when you look at the third Ginn factor, it talks about it's adequate on its face to state a claim of legal error. And I'm not sure that just a bald-faced statement as to what a third party did or did not do is adequate to state a legal claim.
Why couldn't they have dismissed it under Ginn 1?
Because up to this point, up to the Allende decision, the consistent approach to post-trial delay issues had been to submit affidavits. This court in, I believe it was in Simon, indicated that in most of these cases, the appellant is going to be in the best position to indicate. Now, at the same time, you have a competing interest from the potential employer of someone who just rejected this person for a job. How are they going to go under oath to, or why would they go under oath to indicate why they rejected this person from employment?
Doesn't Allende specifically say what happens then? And that is, the defense then files a submission that says, I asked the employer and they declined to provide it. I mean, that's Allende specifically contemplated that type of situation, understanding that large employers may not want to state for fear of lawsuit. Small employers may not want to even respond or be bothered with it. So Allende does not establish a requirement that anything be submitted from the employer as an absolute requirement. It permits the defense to say, I asked and they wouldn't give.
That's true, Your Honor. It's important to remember, however, that this case was decided by the panel before the Allende decision came out. More importantly, this case was...
Well, it was decided the first time before the... we're here on the second.
Exactly. Yeah, it was decided, yeah. The panel. And the affidavit was submitted in conjunction with the panel decision in this case. More importantly...
So did the Court of Criminal Appeals err by saying, now we have a clearer picture of how this should proceed and give the defense an opportunity to make that submission?
That would have been appropriate. If this is what this court is intending with the Allende decision, which is the way the lower court interpreted, that is this court's intent for the decision, then it would have been appropriate to give the appellant more time to obtain affidavits or return for a debate here. But the important thing I wanted to note was that...
Did the defense ask that of the lower court?
No, Your Honor. It was the government asked for reconsideration, and then that was, from that point, it was taken on papers. But again, the important thing is that this case was before the CCA in 2007, I believe. The time frame that the appellant is talking about where he was denied employment was 2 to 3 years before that. So, again, looking at that in that context, it would put a very enormous burden on an appellant to go back 2 or 3 years, find an employer, find a potential employer, find someone who is familiar with that information.
He's got counsel, doesn't he?
That's true, Your Honor.
Counsel has telephones and means of correspondence, could write a letter, and then counsel could inform the court either what the letter from the employer said in response or that the employer declined to respond.
That's true, Your Honor. And again, considering this is an error of the government's making, the government is just in an exact same position to be able to do the same thing. And the government in this case...
Well, does the government have access to his Costco pay stubs?
No, but the government in this case had a very specific location, two specific stores that the lower court found were factually, found as fact, basically, based on the uncontroverted affidavit.
Does the government have a duty to produce evidence for the appellant?
This court's precedent has indicated that any type of affidavit or any type of information in the post-trial delay context needs to be sufficient enough to provide the government an opportunity to either validate or rebut those allegations. The lower court specifically, in both opinions, indicated that the affidavit in this case was factually specific to give the government that opportunity to rebut this. And they found it very important and actually questioned the ethics of the government to challenge the affidavit without any effort to verify or dispute those allegations made.
Well, counsel, Allende, if that's how it's pronounced, was before my time, but I'm having trouble seeing the difference between what happened in that case and what happened in this case. I mean, in that case, he said that he didn't have employment, and the court found that he hadn't shown any additional evidence, and that they were going to find it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in the absence of any evidence to the contrary, and that's exactly what happened in this case. So how is it inconsistent?
I'm not going to presume to know what exactly influenced the court's decision in Allende. One thing that is important to note is that.
So, I mean, are you saying that it's inconsistent with Allende, or are you saying that Allende was wrong and so this case is wrong too?
No.
Because it seems to me that that's what you're saying.
No, the Allende or Allende decision can be limited to its facts. There's no need for this court to go and say that Allende was wrongly decided.
But how are the facts in that case different from the facts in this case?
A few distinctions was that at the lower level, at the CCA level, the appellant in Allende did not raise the issue of post-trial delay. So...
But they assumed, Allende assumed that they assumed that there was error. So we'll leave all that aside. They assumed that there was error.
But
whether he raised it at the lower level or not, they assumed that there was error, and they moved on to determine whether it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Exactly. And one of the questions it asks is, how is this prejudice the appellant? It seems counterintuitive or undercuts the appellant's argument here before this court to say that he was prejudiced, suffered employment prejudice when he didn't find it worthy enough to raise it before the lower court, and also more importantly, once the case did.
But does it say that anywhere in the opinion? Does the opinion rest or turn on that point?
It doesn't say one way or the other, Your Honor. All it simply says is that based on the affidavit, you find that the.
Did you look at the affidavit in Allende? Have you had a chance to look at that? Do you know whether did the appellant in Allende identify a specific employer or a specific place or give the court any information upon which it could base a decision?
My understanding from the affidavits in Allende, again, this is not in the record, but I can proffer this to the court and if necessary submit a supplemental briefing on it, was that the appellant did identify four specific potential employers. However, the government also submitted an affidavit in Allende before this court saying that it could not find one of the employers and that two of the employers it did contact, the specific reason for not hiring the appellant was something completely separate from the lack of a DD-214. Now, again, because that's not in the record or in the opinion, if the court would like, I can try to.
You're referring to a public record, though.
I am. Yeah. Yes, Your Honor.
How many stores does Costco have in California, if you happen to know?
I did a Google search, Your Honor, and there's numerous stores in California.
And which one did he work at?
I don't know, Your Honor, but it is a store in Huntsville, Alabama. There's one store at
right,
Costco.
But he said that he worked for Costco in California, so that's pretty specific, some store in California. And are you saying, based on that, the government should have gone out and found out which Costco in California? I heard you say that it was up to the government now to rebut that. Based on the specificity of a Costco in California.
The focus could have been more specifically on the Huntsville, Alabama store, because that is the one that denied the appellant employment based on a lack of a DD-214. Even if he wasn't hired at the store in California, you still have the fact that he was denied employment in the Huntsville, Alabama store. So the government could have easily went to the Huntsville.
And how many Costcos are there in Huntsville? Do you happen to know?
Okay, it's not in the record, but I Googled it, and there was one. At least according to Google.
Not in the record.
Well, that's as good as it gets.
I only did a 25-mile radius. But again, the point is that we're here addressing this issue because of the government's 7-year delay. The court, in other cases, has indicated that it has a very short temper with the court, with the government when it does things like this. And especially in this case, the lower court was particularly upset by the fact that the government contested what was said and made absolutely no effort to go ahead and rebut it. Didn't try to call. Even the administrative division at the Navy, which is also included in the appellant's affidavit, he indicated he tried to contact the Navy's appellate leave division to find out about the status of his discharge papers. The government didn't even go as far to call its own division to find if there was any record of that.
But under Allende, isn't that fine? I mean, what's wrong with that? I mean, what you're talking about is what happened, I think, the first time, and the criticism that the court had as to how the government responded. But after Allende came out and said, we're playing with different rules now, or not necessarily different rules, but we're stating clearly here what the rules are. What was wrong with the government's position in this case?
But again, the panel decision was made before the Allende decision.
Right.
So
yeah.
We do have that change. If Allende is interpreted the way that the lower court did interpret it, I mean, it does constitute represent a significant change in the analysis to say now that not only is an uncontested, unrefuted affidavit sufficient, you also need to now get additional corresponding evidence. That would be the first time that this court would have held specifically that you need something more than that.
Well, isn't that what it said?
Well, that's what Allende says. That's what the way the lower court interpreted it, and this is this court's intention for it, that does represent something.
But isn't that in the context of the question that Judge Erdman asked at the outset? That is, it's not simply a question of an uncontested affidavit in which the person is asserting something about themselves. They're also asserting something about a third party. And in that case, Allende says we need something to verify the truth of the statement with respect to the third party, the employer. In that context, is your fallback position that, as I understand it, that the state of the law at the time the affidavit was submitted was that an affidavit appeared to be sufficient. And if the court has now identified a greater degree of specificity required, the defense ought to have an opportunity to meet that greater degree of specificity. Is that your bottom line here?
Basically, Your Honor, yes. One further issue regarding the lower court's interpretation of Allende's application was that the panel decision not only found due process violation as well as prejudice under harmless error analysis because of the Barker analysis and the employment prejudice, but completely independent under the Toohey analysis, finding that regardless of whether there was employment prejudice here, the delay in this case and the government's lack of any effort to explain or to rebut the appellant's claims so compromised the integrity of the military justice system that due process was...
What's the connection between public perception and prejudice, or is there one?
Well, in the lower court's panel decision, it seemed to kind of merge the two.
If you show public perception, is that enough, or do you have to show prejudice?
Well, this court's decision in Toohey, which is the case that set forth this public perception basis, the appellant in that case did not submit an affidavit alleging any sort of prejudice, just relied on the delay itself. So interpreting Toohey, interpreting from that, it would be perception itself would be enough.
Are you familiar with any other court in the country that finds that public perception constitutes a constitutional violation? I mean, I understand that it may constitute an egregious behavior for which a remedy can be crafted, but isn't that different than saying something is a constitutional violation? I mean, Barker versus Whitten. Barker doesn't talk about that, does it?
No, Your Honor. And there is no specific case that I'm aware of indicating as much. But you do have the unique scenario here where we have the military justice system extrapolating certain portions of the civilian federal system and trying to make that work.
Are we allowed to create constitutional violations?
I see the amount of time, Your Honor, if I can...
Please go ahead.
There has been nothing since Toohey, which was decided, I believe, back in 2005, to indicate that the court is refrained from doing that. The government did not raise the issue to the lower court in this case, nor has it raised the issue in any other post-trial delay case that I'm aware of to the lower court or to this court. This court is free to make that determination in light of any restriction, I believe. I'm not sure if that answers your question. I don't have any authority to say
it's
that.
It's an answer.
I don't have any authority to say that it doesn't, I guess, is the way I would answer.
Where do we draw the line on public perception? Is it like Justice Stewart's pornography?
You know, when you see it, Your Honor, I believe that would partly be it.
Who knows it when he sees it? A reasonable man? A reasonable John Q. Public? Lawyers that practice before this court, or what? Whom?
I think it would be appropriate to apply the reasonably prudent person standard. Again, in Toohey, there was a 6-year delay that the court found violated public perception. Here we have more than 7 years, and at least an effort by the appellant to demonstrate prejudice on top of that. I see I'm out of time. If I have no further questions, so.
You have an opportunity to rebuttal. Counsel, before you start, I'd like to turn your attention to page 7 of the CCA opinion, where the Court of Criminal Appeals says, in this instance, the appellant identified a specific store in a specific town during a specific time frame. He specifically asserted the reason he was denied employment was directly tied to lack of 214 arising from the dilatory post-trial processing of his court-martial. Is that a finding of fact by the Court of Criminal Appeals?
I would say that yes, that is, Your Honor, based on the appellant's unrebutted affidavit.
So what more do we need to know in this case?
I'm sorry, could you...
What more do we need to know in this case? We have an unrebutted fact from the appellant. The Court of Criminal Appeals has found that fact. And so why isn't that sufficient in this case to move forward and decide whether or not there's prejudice?
It could be, and in the case could nonetheless be decided on the fact that ultimately this court has never defined exactly what prejudice is in the employment context. I discussed that briefly in a footnote in my brief, is how do you exactly determine prejudice? Is it a wholesale, I can't get a job anywhere, or is it I just couldn't get the job I wanted? And the court hasn't specifically answered that question. If the court sees it necessary to answer that question, the government would respectfully submit that if the appellant does have employment, perhaps the employment he has should be judged against what employment he could be expected to get as a convicted felon.
See, I'm confused by what they say in the next paragraph. While the appellant provided an adequately detailed declaration and I'm not critical of the Court of Criminal Appeals here, it may be a result of our case law. While the appellant provided an adequately detailed declaration articulating prejudice to his employment opportunities, so they're satisfied with the facts, he has not met his additional burden to provide corroborating evidence or an explanation why such evidence could not be obtained. Why would the defendant have to provide any more facts if they were satisfied with that they know the facts as to what happened?
I would say because this court has long required in its jurisprudence going back at least to United States v. Jenkins and perhaps also all the way back to United States v. Gray, that in the post-trial employment prejudice context, the appellant is required to provide independent, substantiated evidence beyond.
Have we ever said that when a court of criminal appeals has determined that there is an adequately detailed declaration articulating prejudice to his employment opportunities, in this case, a finding that he had found that he had a specific town, a specific store, a specific time frame? Have we ever said that that's inadequate?
Not when the Court of Criminal Appeals goes out and makes that fact-finding. However, the government...
Right. And in Allende, was there a specific town, specific store, specific time frame as to any of the employers?
Not as far as the opinion reflects, Your Honor, no.
How about the underlying record?
I did not read the underlying record in Allende. I apologize for that, Your Honor. However, I believe that that would... United States v. Ginn cautions against fact-finding in the first instance at the appellate level, and Ginn is, and the framework generally for finding a fact at the post-trial level is predicated on the idea that both parties are going to have the opportunity to present facts. Now, in the ineffective assistance, in a typical ineffective assistance case, where appellant, for example, submits an affidavit and the court finds that it meets the initial threshold that Ginn sets forth, then the court stops and says, hey, government, this meets the initial threshold, get a rebuttal affidavit from the defense counsel.
And did the Court of Criminal Appeals in this case, or did the government before the Court of Criminal Appeals say, this affidavit is inadequate? We don't know what he's talking about. We don't know where the store is. We don't know anything about this place. We can't rebut it.
And they didn't say it was inadequate, nor did they ever say it was adequate enough to require the government to respond in some way.
Did the government challenge it under Ginn at the Court of Criminal Appeals?
No, but then there was never quite, we never reached that point where the court said, hey, there's an initial showing under Ginn. I'm sorry, I normally pronounce it Ginn. I don't know if it's Ginn or Ginn. Allende. However, ordinarily, if there is going to be a contested issue, a fact where the court has found that there's initially at least enough evidence where the appellant has met his initial burden of production, then the government should be afforded the opportunity, rather than just blowing right through to the final conclusion, the government should be afforded the opportunity to either expressly admit that those facts are true, or to contest those facts, or to expressly rebut those facts.
So did the Court of Criminal Appeals err by not doing that?
It could be said that they erred. However, ultimately, they reached the correct decision.
Because you won.
it's easy to say because we won below, but also because the court properly applied this court's case law in Allende, and it's the government's vision. Allende properly incorporates the longstanding case law that there be some independent substantiated evidence.
Well, why? I'm sorry. Finish your
thought. As far as conflicting with Jin, the Allende does not conflict with Jin. Jin has never really expressly been applied to a point of prejudice case, but in any case, the Allende requirement, which also trails back to Jenkins and Timmons for independent substantiated evidence, closely parallels the Jin requirement to set forth specific facts instead of speculative or conclusory observations.
Well, then why wouldn't it be in a case like this that even when you have a precisely detailed and specific affidavit, that if it's not substantiated, that it's Jin 1 or Gen 1? And it basically it fails to state a legal claim that they can be denied relief because there's no legal claim stated.
That would be another way of resolving the issue. If they fail to provide an independent substantiated evidence, then Jin's first factor would be a basis. Because this court requires independent substantiated evidence, if there's no independent substantiated evidence, it fails to state a legal claim under Jin 1. So that's an alternative method of resolving this issue. I think this case demonstrates the government went on at length about...
Can I ask one... I'm sorry, was that part of that response?
No, I was...
You're going off to something else?
I'll be happy.
You argue the kitchen sink in your brief.
Yes, sir.
You're starting with no jurisdiction to something else. You know, what is the essence of your argument? What is the... If you're up here presenting one argument that you hope we're focusing on, when we discuss this case, what is that?
From the outset, Allende is good law, and the lower court correctly decided this case based upon Allende. However, this case presents the court for an opportunity to clarify its existing case law and recognize that there is a distinction between the due process analysis for post-trial claims and just an error in prejudice analysis under the statutory Article 59A and 66C review as recognized in Tardif. It became common more recently to focus on the due process analysis, and then with United States v. Allison, where this court recognized that it was appropriate to just assume prejudice and move to the end and see if there was harmless beyond reasonable doubt.
Can I... make sure I understand it. So your first piece is stick with the Allende, apply it, and appellant hasn't met his burden, see Allende.
Correct.
Second, though we wouldn't get to this if you were correct, clarify what standard of prejudice is applied in the context of cases like this,
yes, sir.
59 or constitutional.
That's correct.
Is that a fair?
That's fair.
It's not my position. I just want to make sure I have your position.
Yes.
Since right now I have the sink.
And if I could take the opportunity to explain, the government's position is that as far as the due process analysis is concerned, traditional due process concerns as far as an error at trial that may affect due process, the error is harmless if it didn't contribute to the conviction or the sentence in the case during the trial, and that's Kreutzer. How do we apply that to the post-trial context, I believe, was answered conclusively by Marino. And per Marino, there's a due process violation after reviewing the Barker factors with delay as well as prejudice. At trial, you're concerned about the findings and sentence, the integrity of the findings and sentence. On appeal, the concern is the integrity of the appellate process and any follow-on things that may happen. And Moreno identified via Barker those concerns. First is oppressive incarceration. Clearly, if an appellant has an underlying meritorious issue on appeal and he's languishing in prison because his appeal, the record has been mislaid or the government is otherwise not abiding by its duty to get the record up to the Court of Criminal Appeals, clearly there's a due process issue because he's in prison when he shouldn't be if he has a meritorious issue. The second issue is the constitutionally cognizable undue anxiety. The third issue is...
Well, let's not jump past that second one so quickly. This is a little different than in the Article III courts because in our system, until we get a resolution, these individuals aren't discharged from the military. They don't get their DD-214, which obviously causes employment problems that we're debating right now.
Yes, Your Honor.
If an individual has been convicted and has appealed his case or her case, and the case is lost for 6 years, and it's 7 or 8 years before the Court of Criminal Appeals takes action on it, and assuming that individual is having employment difficulties, wouldn't that constitute undue anxiety? They have no idea what's going on. They're not getting a response. What more do you need? I mean, you just said that oppressive incarceration can consist of an individual sitting in prison not knowing what the result of their appeal is. Where's the difference here?
This court didn't explain it in too much detail, although they did say that Moreno does require that an appellant specifically show, so it places at a very minimum the initial burden of production upon the appellant to specifically show why he is suffering some anxiety that is above and beyond the normal anxiety awaiting the outcome of an appeal.
Well, but I understand what you're saying, but to answer Judge Erdman's question, why isn't it undue anxiety to wonder if you're ever going to work again?
If a person can't get a job at all, maybe that could be. Maybe that would be enough. That goes back again to, is a $7 an hour job in Alabama the fact that he can't get anything better, and we don't know how diligent his job search is, but is that automatically prejudiced because he couldn't get a job he says he was entitled to?
But let's assume here, just for purposes of this, that in fact the individual can't get a job because they don't have a DD-214.
Yes.
And they're awaiting the resolution of this appeal that's out there somewhere in Washington, D.C., and nobody knows. In that situation, could that constitute undue anxiety?
I do believe it could, yes, Your Honor. I think it would be appropriate for this court to say that could be undue anxiety, but in Moreno, this court required that the appellant to produce specific evidence.
So it's a proof issue, not a theory issue.
Yes, so you could just incorporate the requirement that Allende and Jenkins and lots of case law recognize that there's independent substantiated evidence or a reason why the appellant cannot provide that information.
But that would open the door to further inquiry.
Certainly could, Your Honor.
Well, in terms of the independent evidence, is it enough for them to say that they couldn't get a job because they didn't have their DD-214, or would they also have to show that Costco wants to hire someone that has a dishonorable discharge? Because, I mean, that's the thing I don't understand in some of these cases. I'm just being frank with you, which is, I would think that in some sense you're better off not having a DD-214 and having one that says that you've got a bad conduct discharge or a dishonorable discharge.
Yes, Your Honor, and that was a concern that I can't recall offhand if I actually cited it in my brief, but that was a concern in some of the older employment prejudice cases, was how is appellant's lot improved by DD-214 reflecting a criminal conviction and a punitive separation.
What evidence do you have that employers in general won't hire service members who have punitive discharges? I know there are old studies that show the difficulty that people have.
The government is not aware of any formal study that's been done. Certainly there's anecdotal evidence that...
But don't we know for a fact, based on past cases that have been before this court, that there are employers who will not hire someone who lacks a 214, because if they give an honest answer to the prospective employer about their situation, they could say, if I win my case tomorrow, they're going to put me back in the Marine Corps. I'm already in the Marine Corps. They're going to put me back in active duty, and they could send me to Iraq.
That's very true, Your Honor.
What is it the government wants? We have here appellate delay in these cases, 5, 6, 7 years. The government wants to have more now, right? That's how I read your brief. Let's not end this. Let's have another trial. Let's have a debate proceeding so we can bring in lots of witnesses to find out what the nature of this anxiety is. Is that where we should go?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's...
May give it to you then, and the government may... Is that what the Department of Defense wants as a whole? Is that what your fellow services want?
if the appellant meets his initial burden under Allende of providing independent substantiated evidence, and also the, I don't think we even get there under the law if the case without that egregious delay in the first place. The Moreno set forth the familiar timelines now. A case can be well within the Moreno guidelines. Somebody may have a...
Let's just talk about this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
As an example, we'll make it hypothetical, so you don't have to concede it. Let's assume that in this case, he has produced information that identifies the specific employer and the specific employment practice, and they won't hire him without a DD-214. So the government then wants to say, that's not good enough. Let's have a debate hearing to find out how anxious he really was.
And the government, once he meets that initial threshold and the court says, government, he's met the threshold and we're now requiring you to respond in some matter, that, now the ball is in the government's court. And the government can say, no, we're not going to pursue this any further. We're just going to agree with him. And
is it going to be like the last case we heard this morning where we're going to bring in psychologists and experts to testify in a debate hearing about a 6 or 7 year old case that's already been delayed that we can't proceed any further until we've spent more money to determine whether someone's anxious or not? Is that what the government wants?
Ultimately, yes, Your Honor. If these claims are going to be permitted, then and we're going to resolve these disputed factual issues, the appropriate method of resolving those disputed factual issues is ultimately via debate if it can't be done via affidavits at the appellate level. Now, there may be a situation where, hey, we agree with him. You know, he got he suffered prejudice, and therefore the result may be what the lower court initially decided, which was approving only a bad conduct.
Let me ask you this. If this were all validated, would that constitute prejudice in this case?
And that goes back once again.
Let's say you had the president of Costco with an affidavit saying, you bet, this was our man. And as a convenience to you, here are his pay stubs from California. Would the government say that's prejudicial and meaningful relief is warranted, or would the government still be here saying, sorry, that's not undue anxiety, that's something else, go away?
That would reach the ultimate question, Your Honor, of what employment prejudice is.
You're dancing, which is it? I mean, it sounds like you can't get there from here no matter what. The government's saying, we're arguing this on Allende, but oh, by the way, the trick is if you satisfy Allende, you still lose.
The court never, this court has never specifically laid out, is it I can't get any job or I just, is it enough that I couldn't get
this job? So in your view, as long as there is a job somewhere for this person, or he proves that there is no job in any state in the United States, I don't know where this is going, but.
Well, and that's.
I hear you're saying the president of Costco says, I would have hired this guy knowing full well of his dishonorable discharge or whatever it is. You're saying that ain't no prejudice. He could get a job somewhere else. Is that the government's position, by the way?
And I think it's a factual issue that's dependent upon each case. If it's.
No, I'm giving you that hypothetical. That's your case.
Well, how much was he going to be paid at Costco? Is it $13 an hour in Huntsville as well as California?
It's not prejudicial not to get a job because of appellate due process delay?
But he has a job, Your Honor, and that's...
What's
that's
the job? Waiting for his 214 or...
He admits that he's working and earning at least $7 an hour. He just obviously would prefer to have the job at Costco. And that's the threshold question is it... Is it prejudice because he couldn't get the job he wanted, or is it only prejudice if he can't get any job that he is qualified for? And I'm sorry, I'm out of time. If I could,
and can you continue?
And for example, you have
no, please don't. Go ahead.
If you have an attorney who has a conviction and through some miracle retains his law degree, but no law firm will hire him, and he can only get a job in working retail at a considerably lower salary, is that prejudiced as opposed to somebody who's arguing?
I understand the argument. As a general matter, surely the government is of the view that it's better for convicted felons to have jobs than not have jobs. You would agree with that?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, just the government can concede that
And I thought, I mean, we're talking about debate here, and I thought that your position was fairly simple, which is that the lower court got it right and we should affirm it.
Yes, Your Honor. I have a lot of extra stuff in my brief just because the...
And if he had provided information and documentation, then they may have come out differently, and this would be a different case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, I don't hear you saying I hear you saying we should affirm it, but not that the lower court got it right. Because if the lower court got it right, you agree that appellant's declaration states a claim of legal error and provides adequate detail. You agree with that? And if so, then that's the standard?
Or is it they got it wrong because it should have been Gen 1?
They ultimately got it right. However, the government...
I just wanted to...
They should have formed a different...
The result was right, but for the wrong reasons.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your Honor, Judge Baker just gave a hypothetical to government counsel. Assuming that all the facts that were alleged in the appellant's affidavit was validated. That's what happened before the lower court, as Your Honor indicated as well. The lower court found that these facts were accurate because they were uncontested, unrefuted by the government, and in light of the Gin factors, it was able to accept those allegations or assertions as facts.
But how could he accept it? They could accept them as facts for purposes of Gin, but they're not facts for purposes of the end date. Meaning facts that constitute a showing of prejudice.
And that's where the lower court in this case we misinterpreted the Lende, because Jin says you can accept those as facts. You have on the record facts that this court must accept, because this court is a court of law, not a court of facts, must accept those conclusions as fact. So you have before you a record where the appellant was had a specific job potential at Costco in Huntsville, Alabama, and was denied that because of the DD-214.
But why is it not the case that in a case like this, that unless substantiation is provided, that it's Gen 1? In light of Allende, whatever it is.
Because again, well, first he has a couple of different reasons. They talked about the undue anxiety. The affidavit in this case is sufficient enough for this court to conclude that there was undue anxiety. The appellant, on his own initiative, called the administrative division asking about his DD-214 when he lost his job or job potential with Costco. So you do have a legal claim. The court below also found that the facts were sufficient to state a legal claim. They specifically say that in both the panel and the CCA opinion, the en banc opinion. The only thing different, and the lower court admitted this, the only thing different was what the court called an additional burden of Allende now. So it's interpreting Allende as imposing on top of Gin an additional burden to find, to establish what has already been found to be uncontested, unrefuted facts.
Well, then why wouldn't it be just as good for us to say, lower court, you reached the right result, but your analysis was incorrect. What you should have done is in light of Allende, apply Gin 1 and said, go back and substantiate this or you haven't stated a claim.
In that case, again, it would be a unique and before this unprecedented shift in the analysis and post-trial delay cases, and if that would be the case, it should have given the appellant the opportunity to, under this new set of rules, go back and try to and obtain the evidence necessary to substantiate the new or meet the new standard. Two things real quick. I do see I'm almost out of time. Even though
don't rush. Take your time to finish your thought.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Thank you. One other thing the lower court did with Allende was apply it to the harmless error analysis, which created, as I indicated before, this unprecedented shift in the burden. We have here a person who, again, based on affidavit, made at least a factually sufficient claim of legal harm, and then they do find a due process violation. The burden supposedly shifts to the government, but in addressing this harmless error, focuses solely on the appellant's failure in light of Allende to provide more information. Even though they didn't say this to the lower court, that the practical effect was that it shifted it to the burden to the appellant, which, of course, is is inconsistent precedent, especially Supreme Court's decision in Chapman. And then one final thing, if I, real quickly, Your Honor, with regard to Judge Erdman's comment about the unique status of the military, and also getting back to your question, Your Honor, Judge Ryan, about TUI, and is it appropriate to find due process in light of the adverse perception? The military is a unique environment. Unlike other appellants, other defendants, this person is still on active duty and is hamstrung in a way from getting employment until his or her case is resolved at the appellate level. For that reason, it would be appropriate or TUI to find a due process violation for the adverse perception, which the lower court did in this case, independent of Allende. Because the lower court did apply Allende in an inconsistent manner and inappropriate in light of this court's intention for this decision, this court should set aside the lower court's opinion.
Thank you, counsel. We gave the defense a bit more time there. Does the government have anything further they want to add? Thank you. The case is now submitted. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation. The court will be in recess pending further order of the court.
Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.